This is Relationships 2.0. I'm Michelle Skeen. My guest today is Martin Anthony. He is the author of the Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook, Proven Step-by-Step Techniques for Overcoming Your Fear. I wanted to have Martin on because he is an expert in the area of anxiety, and I thought that it would be a great way to continue to kick off the year by addressing our fears and figuring out ways in which we can combat them. So I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Martin Anthony. Thank you for joining me, Martin. I'm happy to be here discussing your book, The Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook, Proven Step-by-Step Techniques for Overcoming Your Fear. Welcome.
Thank you, and thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, I really love your workbook, and I love the way it's laid out, but one of the things I've been thinking a lot about lately is that when we don't bring awareness to our struggles, that it's difficult to find a solution for them. And in the beginning of your book, you identify ways in which, well, you clarify what is anxiety and what is fear, and I'd love to have you discuss that. But also, you identify behaviors that are indicative of shyness or social anxiety.
Yeah, so do you want me to just start with anxiety and fear?
Start wherever. Actually, you know, I'd love for you to start and just tell our listeners who you are and all of the work and the research that you do and where you are and all of that.
Okay, sure. I'm Martin Anthony. I'm a psychologist based in Toronto. I'm a professor at Ryerson University in Toronto, and I also founded Canada's largest anxiety disorder specialty clinic about 20 years ago in Hamilton, Ontario, St. Joseph's Healthcare, and was there for a long time as the founding director there. So I've been working in the area of anxiety and related problems for over 30 years now. And this new workbook, the Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook, this is the third edition, is my 30th book. Most of my books are on anxiety and related problems, and this is actually the third edition, as I mentioned, of this particular book that just came out about a month ago. And I think the first edition came out right around the year 2000, plus or minus a year. So this book's been around for a little while now.
And your bio is incredibly impressive. And also, you're clearly passionate about this topic. And I'd love for you to run through the numbers of how many people identify as being shy or having some kind of anxiety, or maybe specifically social anxiety. The numbers are high.
The numbers are very high. So in terms of anxiety, just generally, almost all of us would report that we've experienced anxiety at one time or another. And there's some old survey data it's a few decades old now, but just surveys of the general population that have found that about 40% of people, this is work from Philip Zimbardo and his colleagues, 40% of people currently consider themselves to be chronically shy to the point of it being a problem. Another 40% consider themselves to have previously been shy. 15% of people consider themselves to be shy in some situations, and only 5% of people reported that they were never shy in some of those surveys. So most of us can relate to the idea of feeling anxious around others or uncomfortable around others or kind of introverted or withdrawn around others. And that's, this book is, it'd be great if 95% of the population bought this book, but the book's not really aimed at the sort of shyness that we all experience from time to time. It's aimed more at levels of shyness that are causing problems for people, that are interfering with their relationships, with their work, with their hobbies, with the sorts of things that they want to be doing in their lives.
And that's the important thing. I mean, sometimes we don't even know that, though. We just know that, oh, I don't really like to do that. That's why I really appreciate your book and all of the list of things that might be going on if this is an issue for you.
Yeah, in some ways, shyness and social anxiety, they're like personality traits, and people may just see these things as the way they are. They may not have anything else to compare it to because they've kind of always been this way, and may not see it as a problem sometimes until somebody points it out, or until they lose their job and all of a sudden have to apply for new jobs and they can't interview for jobs. It can be sort of insidious and hard to recognize sometimes.
What is the difference between anxiety and fear? I think that's a really important distinction that you make in your book.
Yeah, so there are different ways that people define those terms out there, and there are some people who even use those terms interchangeably. I think for most emotion theorists, and certainly the way a lot of us think about anxiety-based problems now, they are different states. So fear is the emotion, it's sort of a basic all-or-nothing emotion, that fight-or-flight response or panic reaction that we get when we're faced with some sort of immediate threat. You know, if a bear is chasing you, that's fear. If you're about to get into a car accident, you might experience fear. And fear is designed to protect us from that immediate threat. Usually when there's a strong fear response, there's a strong desire to get out of the situation as quickly as possible. And again, it's part of that fight or flight response. Sometimes when we're faced with threat, it's more of an aggressive response. And we do see higher levels of anger and aggression in people who are prone to anxiety as well. It's not surprising because, again, both of those can be responses to threat. Anxiety, on the other hand, is more of a future-oriented kind of state. So when we're dwelling on something or anticipating some future threat, maybe you've got a big exam or you've got a presentation you have to give a week from now or something like that, that future-oriented angst is anxiety, and that's not so much designed to protect you from some immediate threat. When we're anxious, we don't want to run away the way we might if we're experiencing fear. When we're anxious, we may go into problem-solving mode where we try to sort of prepare for that threat in advance. We may try to distract ourselves from thinking about that threat. You know, for a lot of us, when we were students, the time that our home was the cleanest was during exam time, because we would do everything we can, including cleaning the house, to not study. Right. So those are kind of typical responses to anxiety. And not only do they have a different purpose, fear and anxiety, but they're also, you know, biologically they're different as well. So we know that fear is very much based in the amygdala, for example, and neurotransmitters in the brain, like norepinephrine, are involved in fear, whereas different neurotransmitters, GABA, which is gamma-aminobutyric acid, are involved in anxiety. So we see different sort of chemically in the brain, different things happening with fear and anxiety as well.
Has the ability to study like MRI and imaging or whatever form gets used been helpful in breaking this down for you as technology has advanced?
So one of the reasons we know about the role of the amygdala and fear, for example, is through brain imaging studies like fMRI or PET scans, studies that look at activity in the brain, look at blood flow and other markers of brain activity to see which areas of the brain are active during different emotional states. There's still lots to be done in that area, and some other problems have been studied much more than social anxiety, things like obsessive compulsive disorder, for example. We know a lot more about what's happening in the brain in OCD than we do in social anxiety, but it's an area that's continuing to grow, though.
What makes a panic attack? What's going on with the individual when they're having a panic attack?
So a panic attack is essentially just a rush of fear. And it's a rush of fear that happens in the absence of some sort of realistic threat, typically. So a panic attack, technically, according to the definition, it has to come on quickly and has to peak within minutes. It can last longer, but the rise time to the peak has to be within just a few minutes. And usually a panic attack peaks within seconds. You can imagine if a bear was chasing you, you wouldn't want it to take a few minutes to get scared. You know, you'd want to have that response immediately. And that's often what we see with panic attacks. In addition, it has to include at least 4 out of a list of 13 symptoms. And most of those symptoms are symptoms of physical arousal, things like a racing heart or sweating or shaking or dizziness, breathlessness, those sorts of things. But some of the symptoms are more psychological symptoms. One of the symptoms of panic attacks that are often kind of unexpected and frightening for people are involve feelings of unreality, feelings of depersonalization, feeling unreal or detached from one's environment. So that can make people sort of doubt their mental health and whether they're kind of losing control or something like that. Mm-hmm. We also see sometimes during panic attacks, fears of dying, fears of going crazy, fears of losing control. And in panic attacks, they can happen out of the blue. We see that often in a problem called panic disorder, where people have unexpected panic attacks. but usually they're triggered by something. And in the case of social anxiety, they're triggered by a fear of being judged or evaluated by others, making a fool of oneself, being embarrassed, those sorts of situations.
And you also say it's important to have a little bit of anxiety, or there's a healthy level of anxiety that we all need.
Yes. So, you know, if we never felt anxious, we'd probably get ourselves into trouble. And it kind of reminds me, I never saw this movie, but I remember the commercials for it, a Jim Carrey movie called Liar Liar, where mm-hmm. Jim Carrey loses the ability to lie. And, you know, we often think of lying as something that's bad. But in this movie that I never saw, but my impression of the movie anyway, is that in this movie, he lost that ability to lie, and he actually ended up getting himself into trouble. He ended up saying things to people that, you know, were very hurtful to them and so on, because he always had to tell the truth. And it's the same with anxiety and social anxiety. If you had no social anxiety, no shyness, you didn't care at all what people thought of you, you'd get yourself into trouble. You'd say things that would get you fired. You'd hurt your partner and maybe lose your relationship. You know, we want to be a little bit concerned about what other people think of us. You know, the way we behave at a party should be different than the way you behave at a funeral. And mm-hmm. part of what kind of tells us how to behave is that anxiety that, well, if I say the wrong thing right now, there's going to be consequences. So that's actually a good thing in moderation.
But when it gets in the way of important things in your life, that is when it creates problems.
Exactly. So if you go into these situations with the assumption that people are going to judge you, even when they're probably not going to judge you, or if you go into these situations assuming that the consequence of being evaluated, consequences will be horrible, even though they're probably more manageable than you think, then you might find that you kind of overprotect yourself in those situations, and you may avoid those situations completely, and that ends up costing people as well. You know, if you go to a party and you end up avoiding eye contact and standing in the corner and avoiding people and talking very quietly or not going to the party at all, then that communicates a message as well, and people, you know, your attempts to not be judged may actually lead you to experience that judgment that you're trying so hard not to experience.
And did you find, between the time that you initially wrote the book and you did the third edition, which means that you've added material that wasn't in the first two editions, that the popularity of social media and all of the different types of social media, like Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook, and so much stuff online has enabled people to maybe lean into their social anxiety versus finding successful ways to combat it?
I think it's kind of the effect of social media has been complicated. I think it's in some cases probably worsened people's social anxiety. Mm-hmm. In other cases, it's sort of given them a way to avoid sort of in-person contact. Social media, one of the problems with social media is that everybody presents themselves on Facebook and other sites as having this amazing life, right? They put the best possible photos of themselves on there, and they are constantly posting about with their vacation photos, and every time they do anything fun, it's kind of on there. And it's very easy for people to look at people's Facebook pages and assume that everybody else is having more fun than them, and that their life is boring, and that it may lead people to feel more self-conscious and more embarrassed by what's happening with them. Social media also forces people to kind of put themselves out there a bit, and some people with social anxiety don't really want to share details about their lives. So they may find that difficult, that pressure. And also, in some cases, that may be helpful. If people find it difficult to share details about themselves, social media may be a way of kind of helping people to confront that fear. So I can imagine for some people that would actually be a positive thing. If I was working with somebody who was afraid to disclose certain kinds of information on social media that you know, nothing that would get them into trouble, but just stuff that the average person discloses, that might encourage them to practice doing that if they were afraid of doing that. The other thing with social media is it can be a good bridge to real-life practices. So if somebody's afraid of socializing with others and they're avoiding social media and they're terrified of making friends and interacting with others, social media might be a sort of a helpful step toward those kind of real-life interactions, whereas in the past we wouldn't have had that in-between step. So I think it can be a positive thing in social anxiety, but it can also contribute to it as well.
And I was thinking that, and you talk about it in the book, about online dating or, you know, in terms of social anxiety, like maybe someone, you mentioned a guy who doesn't go out on dates because he has social anxiety. And I was thinking about how often I've had so many experiences with clients who have done online dating. They're having this great exchange with someone, and then it's time to meet, and the other person doesn't want to meet.
So the client wants to meet, but the other individual doesn't want to meet.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that, we talk about, I think I talk about it in the book, if not, it's certainly something I talk about with clients, is that the more risks you take, the more rejection you're going to experience. Mm-hmm. And, a big part of overcoming social anxiety is not so much learning that you won't be rejected, because that's probably not realistic, but rather learning to tolerate that rejection. And you know, a lot of people who are very socially anxious, it may take them months or even years sometimes to work up the courage to ask somebody out on a date. And then if the other person says no, they're devastated, and they may not take that risk again for many months or years. Excuse me. So on the other hand, you know, one of the things that I talk about with people is that if the odds of a asking someone on a date, the odds of that leading to a good relationship are 1 in 20. If you take that risk once a year, every 20 years you're going to be in a relationship. On the other hand, if you take that risk 3 times a week, within a few weeks you're going to be in a relationship. So taking more risks will definitely lead... Yeah, so taking more weeks will definitely lead to more rejection, but it will also lead to more good things happening in your life. And you know, one of the things, I assume we'll get to this in a bit, that we teach people is how to think about rejection differently. And you know, that same argument is not just for dating. It can be made for applying for jobs. The more jobs you apply for, the more rejection you'll experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, that doesn't mean you shouldn't apply for jobs. That's not the answer.
So that might be, like, the fear of rejection is fueling social anxiety. Is that the way you would say that? Is that correct? Or how would you link those two?
Yeah, I guess the beliefs that people have about rejection, that they're definitely going to get rejected, or that rejection is something to be avoided, would both help to fuel social anxiety. And the behaviors as well. The more people avoid the situations they fear, the more they engage in little safety behaviors to protect themselves from rejection or from other negative consequences. Those avoidance and safety behaviors help to maintain the anxiety over the long term.
And would you say that the primary behaviors for those people dealing with their social, who have social anxiety, who like aren't going through your workbook or working with someone on it, are avoidance behaviors?
Yeah, either overt avoidance, so they're physically just not going into situations, or more subtle forms of avoidance. So, always wearing lots of makeup to hide blushing, or speaking very quietly, or avoiding eye contact, so that they may be going into situations, but they're doing little things to protect themselves. They always arrive to class early so they don't have to walk in and have everyone watching them, for example. So we call those safety behaviors, the little things that people do to make the situations more manageable or prevent harm when they are kind of forced to be in these situations.
And that's so interesting. The comment about the makeup, well, and even going to class early, but the makeup, not being seen without makeup, being a safety behavior.
Yeah. So, for people who are afraid of blushing, they will do things to prevent people from seeing that. So they may wear extra makeup. They may wear turtleneck sweaters to hide their neck. They may, if they go out for dinner, they'll insist on eating in a darkly lit restaurant so that people won't notice they're blushing. People with social anxiety are often afraid not only of saying the wrong thing or looking bad or being judged, but they're also afraid of the anxiety itself and the possibility of the anxiety leading them to be judged. So some of the symptoms of anxiety, things like blushing and sweating and shaking and losing their train of thought, they may work hard to hide those symptoms from others. And again, we all, most of us don't want to look really anxious in front of others, but for people with a lot of social anxiety, that desire to hide those symptoms is often a lot stronger.
What's interesting is so often our safety behaviors have people judging us for different things that isn't even the thing that we're hiding, but is what they might imagine it means.
Yeah. If somebody doesn't... is trying to hide a behavior and that gets noticed, people may wonder what it means. People may assume the worst rather than, that it's just a little bit of anxiety that the person's experiencing. They may assume it's something much more serious than that.
Or even when someone is, I think shy people are often, people think that they're just stuck up or... That's such an old term, stuck up. Does anyone even say that anymore? I think I just seriously dated myself. That
it seems completely reasonable to me, so which means I probably just dated myself as well.
Thank you, Martin. That they're not shy, but they're just like snobby or full of themselves or not friendly. So they're getting almost judged more harshly in a way for some behavior they might be engaging in rather than what the actual issue is with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for a number of different reasons, one is just the behaviors that people engage in to not look anxious. So they may avoid eye contact. They may leave a situation kind of abruptly.
The Irish goodbye. But
also And in addition, they may want to, kind of look strong, so they don't want to look vulnerable, so they look very serious and so on. Some of those behaviors may maybe misinterpreted as being aloof or judgmental. You know, people may assume that the anxious person is actually judging them, whereas the reality is the anxious person is terrified of being judged by them. So, yeah, those behaviors can be misinterpreted for sure.
What do you mind going through some of the interpersonal situations that would be problematic for someone who's dealing with shyness or social anxiety?
Yeah, so we often talk about two different types of social situations. The first one is interpersonal situations, and these are situations involving sort of contact with others, and shyness kind of influences these situations probably more than the second type, which the second type is performance situations. I'll come back to those in a moment. So interpersonal situations that people might find difficult would be things like dating situations and job interviews and starting conversations and keeping conversations going. It could be even things like interacting, if you've ordered a pizza, interacting with the delivery person, or even just making that phone call and interacting with the person on the phone may be very difficult. Mm-hmm. Any situations involving kind of interacting with others, conversation, those sorts of things. The second type of situation are what we call performance situations, and these are situations where people are being observed. So being the center of attention. So the big one that a lot of people don't like is public speaking, but there are lots of others as well. So working out in a gym with other people watching, eating or drinking in front of others can be difficult for some people because if they have shaky hands, people may notice that. So even just walking down the street. I saw one person that I was working with who had a fear of driving, and at first I thought she just had a fear of driving, but it turned out the fear of driving was part of her social anxiety. It wasn't a separate problem. She was afraid of driving, not because she'd get into a car accident, but because other drivers would judge her. You know, we all know that in the car, people can, you know, call other drivers names and, you know, get really angry sometimes, really judgmental. So that's what she was afraid of. So it was really just part of her social anxiety. And for her, that was what I would call a performance kind of situation. It was a fear of being watched and observed and judged. It wasn't so much about interacting with somebody else. So people with social anxiety problems can be afraid of, you know, there's some people who are afraid of just about every social situation you can imagine. Even just leaving the house for them is a social situation because mm-hmm. there's people out there. And for other people, it may be very narrowly focused. It may be just a fear of public speaking that's a problem. And we can see everything in between as well in terms of how broad a scope the problem has.
Was that meaningful for her to have you make that connection about her driving being part of her, her fear of driving being a manifestation of her social anxiety?
Well, it was helpful. It was helpful from a treatment perspective because I didn't really have to treat the fear of driving separately because just working on her social anxiety in a range of other situations automatically led to a reduction in her fear of driving. Whereas if it was a separate problem, if it was a fear of getting into car accidents, you know, in addition to working on the social anxiety, we'd have to come up with this whole other plan to tackle that fear of driving. So it was helpful from from thinking about the problem and thinking about the best approach to overcoming the problem to see the relationship between the fear of driving and the social anxiety.
And how does go ahead, Martin.
I was going to say, I can't remember whether she recognized that relationship. She may have seen that relationship, and I just kind of missed it initially in our assessment. Or maybe she didn't see it either, and we kind of discovered that together. I can't remember now how that unfolded.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about driving is actually social in a way, like in the way you were saying, it can be very, and usually not in a positive way.
Right.
So can you talk about the breakdown of gender, what shyness and social anxiety look like, the differences between men and women, and how what the breakdown is as well, but also how behaviors can be a bit different between genders?
Yeah, so the difference, it's about sort of equal in men and women. Social problems with social anxiety a little bit more common in women in the surveys that are out there, but compared to other anxiety problems, so certain kinds of anxiety problems like animal phobias, for example, are about 90% female. Social anxiety is much more equal, just a little bit more female. So it's more of a universal kind of problem that men and women can both relate to. The same sorts of situations can affect men and women. So things, public speaking and dating and job interviews and those sorts of things. So there's not much difference in terms of the types of situations or the types of physical symptoms that people experience. There may be certain differences in terms of how people cope with those symptoms. So we know, for example, that substance use is one way that people cope with social anxiety. Alcohol, for example, I talked earlier about the neurotransmitter GABA. Alcohol is the neurotransmitter that acts on GABA, and not surprisingly, it reduces anxiety. In some people with social anxiety problems, alcohol use may be a way of combating that. But we know that, in general, alcohol use is a little bit more in men than women. So that may be a way that's changing. Traditionally, anyway, that may be a way that men cope with anxiety more often than women do. Maybe more acceptable for men to express anger in certain ways compared to women, and we may see differences there as well. But for the most part, the symptoms are very and the behaviors are very similar across men and women.
And what about the use of prescription medication for shyness and social anxiety, and also cannabis?
In terms of the use of prescription medication, generally for anxiety, it tends to be more common for women to use prescription medication than men, although men often do as well. I can't remember off the top of my head whether those findings hold up for social anxiety in particular, but I assume that they probably do, don't know that for sure. Generally, it's kind of more acceptable for women to express anxiety than it is for men in our society. So women are more likely in our culture anyway to seek treatment if they are having problems with anxiety, and more likely to talk to their doctor and so on. So I would expect to see more prescription medication use and therapy, psychotherapy use as well amongst women than men. We do definitely see that for other problems. Again, for social anxiety in particular, I can't recall. And then the other piece, what was the other piece you just asked?
I was curious about cannabis.
Because, cannabis.
Yeah. I don't think you guys have that. That's not really being used up in Canada, right, the way that it is in the States?
Well, it's being used recreationally in Canada, and it's being used as a medical treatment in some cases. And it's about to be legalized in Canada as well. If that hasn't already happened, because we've known for so long that it's about to be legalized, people have been behaving as if it's already legal. So I can't remember what the actual date is when it becomes legal. In terms of treatment, though, I can say that there's no question some people will use cannabis to cope with their anxiety. And anecdotally, though, there's no research on the use of cannabis for anxiety disorders in general, or for social anxiety in particular. With one kind of exception, which I'll talk about in a second. I think that'll change as it becomes legal. It'll be easier to do that kind of research. But until recently, it's been difficult to do that sort of research. Anecdotally, some people definitely describe that cannabis kind of calms them down. And other people describe the opposite. I've seen a number of people who have their first panic attack in the context of using cannabis and are terrified of using cannabis because it makes them very anxious. So it can have different effects on different people. What I will mention, though, is there is one study on an extract of cannabis called cannabidiol. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but it's spelled that way anyway. I've never heard anyone say it out loud. Okay. And that study was a placebo-controlled study of this cannabidiol extract compared to placebo for public speaking fear. And it found that that substance, which is present in cannabis, was more effective than placebo for reducing anxiety during public speaking. So whether that means that cannabis would be an effective treatment for public speaking fear or for social anxiety more generally, we don't know. Whether that study is even meaningful, we don't know, because a single study doesn't really tell us much of anything. You know, the way science works is we find something in a study, but then we need to replicate it, and we look at patterns of findings across studies. You know, one of the problems with the media is they'll report individual studies as if they're meaningful in and of themselves, and of course these studies often contradict themselves, and then the public loses faith in science because, you know, there's these contradictory findings. That's actually the way the science is supposed to work. There are contradictory findings because studies use different methods and different samples, and again, we have to look at patterns across studies, and we don't have that yet for cannabidiol, let alone for cannabis, enough studies to see a pattern yet. The other thing, there's something else I was going to mention about that. I can't remember what it is. But I'd say, I guess to answer your question, it's too early to know what the effects of cannabis are and whether it could be used as treatment and whether people should use it or should stay away from it. We just don't know enough about the relationship between cannabis use and social anxiety just yet.
And I would imagine that the fact remains that you need to use a protocol like yours in order to make changes anyway, that may be helpful, medication or whatever, but you still need to change behaviors. Like, medication isn't going to change a behavior.
Yeah, actually, I just remembered what I was going to say, that just because, even if it does help, let's say that using cannabidiol or cannabis reduces your anxiety in the moment, that doesn't mean it's a treatment. Avoidance will reduce your anxiety in the moment.
Right. You
know, if you just leave the situation, you're going to feel relieved and less anxious. But we would never recommend that as a treatment. Often, in fact, the things that reduce anxiety in the moment are kind of the opposite of what we want to do from a treatment perspective. The treatment that we use for social anxiety involves doing things that kind of run counter to what your emotion is telling you to do, and confronting feared situations and doing things that are scary and learning that you can manage that fear. So that seems to be an important part of the treatment, meaning that, again, the use of a drug may undermine treatment, actually, even though in the short term it makes you feel better.
Right. And that's the same with alcohol for people who have anxiety, right? I mean, it's
absolutely,
off,
yeah, it makes
it's a little bit helpful, and then maybe it becomes an additional problem.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk about some of your treatments. I want to get back to, you were discussing rejection and how you guide clients in overcoming fear of rejection and dealing with rejection.
Yes. Yeah, so, sorry, can you repeat?
So overcome how you help clients. I wanted to circle back to rejection,
which
you mentioned earlier. And so I thought it might be nice to get into some of the tools that you provide in your book, The Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook.
Absolutely.
To deal for people who have fear. Everyone has a fear of rejection. I mean, this is going to be helpful for everyone, I think.
Yeah. So, one of the things we do is help people to become aware of the specific predictions that they're making, and to challenge those predictions by looking at the evidence. So as an example, if somebody's walking down the hall at work and they say hello to somebody and that other person ignores them, they might assume that, oh, maybe that person doesn't like me or doesn't respect me or something like that. And somebody with a lot of social anxiety might be more likely to assume that other person not saying hello to them is an indication of rejection. So one of the things we might do, rather than assume that belief is a fact, is we would encourage people to start to question that belief and to look at all the different reasons why somebody might not say hello at work when you say hello to them first. And I would work with the person to generate all those other reasons. Well, maybe they were distracted. Maybe they didn't hear me say hello. Maybe they're shy. Maybe they're just kind of rude. Maybe they don't say hello to anybody. Maybe they did say hello and I didn't hear them. Maybe they weren't feeling well. Maybe they were in a hurry. There's actually lots of reasons why somebody might not say hello. I might also ask the person the question, well, wait a second. Imagine that you were walking down the hall at work and someone who you didn't like said hello to you. What would you do? And most people will say, well, even if I didn't like the person, I'd probably say hello. Well, what does that tell you? Well, it tells me that whether or not someone says hello maybe isn't a good sign of whether they like me, because even if they didn't like me, they'd probably say hello. Then I might ask them the question, what if they didn't like you? You know, what would the consequences of that be? Is it possible to be liked by everybody? You know, can you think of anyone who's liked by everybody? You know, if you think of politicians, there's no politician who's liked or hated by everybody. I mean, there are always going to be exceptions to that. I once asked an audience where I was presenting, you know, can you think of anyone that everybody likes? And somebody screamed out, Mother Teresa. But then other people in the audience shook their heads, and they didn't like Mother Teresa. And I went home and I Googled Mother Teresa, and it turns out there are at least two books written about Mother Teresa that were very negative. Christopher Hitchens wrote one. I can't remember the other author.
Oh, really? That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, now, you know, I might ask someone, you know, if Mother Teresa isn't liked by everybody, what are the chances that you're going to be or I'm going to be? It turns out from a social psychological perspective, there's a lot of research on what makes us like other people. And one of the things that predicts who we like is how similar they are to us. You know, if you find out that somebody's from the same town as you, you're going to like them a little bit better. If you find out they share your religious views or your political views, you're going to like them a little bit better. If they like the same sports team as you, you're going to like them a little bit better. And in other words, the very things that make us likable to some people make us less likable to others. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to be liked by everybody. So we might have that sort of discussion. And the goal of the discussion is really to have people come to the conclusion that, first of all, that thing that happened at work, maybe the person didn't say hello to me, doesn't really necessarily mean that I'm being rejected. It might, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. And second, even if I was rejected, there's no way around that. You know, everybody is rejected sometimes in some situations. Nobody's liked by everybody. So really helping people to think, it's not about positive thinking. It's really about more flexible thinking, being able to look at things from different perspectives, right. More realistic and balanced thinking. So that's a big part of the therapy, is really looking at the thoughts, looking at evidence for those thoughts, asking the question, can I look at this in a different way? So I would say, you know, there's two kind of major groups of strategies that are really important. That's one of them, is really looking at the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I can move on to the other one. Did you
yes,
have any
absolutely.
Questions about that? Should I move on?
This is all super okay. helpful and interesting.
Okay, great. Yeah, the other one is what we call exposure. One of the most powerful ways of changing thinking is through experience. So we want people to test out their beliefs by going into situations and conducting little experiments. What happens if I go in front of an audience, if I'm afraid of losing my train of thought? What if I actually do lose my train of thought? Well, I can actually find out. I can go into the social situation and lose my train of thought and get distracted and see what happens. Or if I'm afraid of drawing attention to myself, I can draw attention to myself. I can drop something in a public place, or I can, you know, one of the things that one of our clients did is she walked around the hospital that I'm affiliated with, which is called St. Joseph's Hospital. She walked around the hospital asking everyone where St. Joseph's Hospital was. And they would say, well, you're in it. And she'd say, well, I don't think so. And they'd say, well, yeah, you are. So her fear was of looking kind of dumb in front of others. And she found that it was anxiety provoking to do that, but it got easier. We learned that whatever she was afraid would happen didn't happen, and she was able to cope with those feelings. So we encourage people to start to do the things that they're afraid of. Right. Nothing that would get them to trouble. You know, I wouldn't have someone go to their boss and say, you're a jerk and I can't stand this place, or wouldn't have them do that. But we pick practices where realistically the consequences are likely to be minimal. And we encourage people to start with easier things and work up to more difficult things until they get easier. So I would say those are the two things that are probably most important. And then we also review in the book some other strategies as well. But I would say that, you know, if I could only pick two, those would be the two looking at the thoughts and confronting feared situations that I'd say are the most important.
And can you talk about the relationship between the emotions and the thoughts and how those are connected and how you deal with those?
So any emotion is really associated with a number of different components or stages in experiencing emotions. So for any emotion, there has to be a trigger of some kind, and that trigger may be a situation or an object. It may be a thought or a prediction that people are making. For example, I could be thinking about some future trigger in a situation. You have to pay attention to that trigger. The other thing, though, that's really important to experience any emotion is you have to appraise the trigger as being relevant in some way. So to bring it back to social anxiety, if I'm giving a presentation and somebody in the presentation looks bored, somebody in the presentation is asleep, the trigger is the person who's asleep. And my emotion is going to really depend on the thought in that situation. So on the one hand, if I look at that person who's asleep and I think, oh no, they don't like my presentation, I might have the emotion of anxiety or fear or something like that, that maybe other people don't like it as well, maybe I'm not doing a good job and so on. On the other hand, if my interpretation of the situation is that person's being inconsiderate, and if they were so tired that they can't stay awake, they shouldn't have come, I might have more of an anger or frustration kind of response.
Right.
If my thought is more one of empathy, where, wow, that person probably didn't have a good night's sleep last night, I know that that's a problem for me sometimes, and I feel for that person that they're kind of stuck here in my presentation and having trouble staying awake, I may not feel anxiety or anger. I may just kind of feel empathy for them or something like that. So depending on people's interpretation, their emotion is going to be different. And one of the assumptions of this therapy is that we don't really respond to events in our lives or situations or objects. What we respond to is our interpretations of those situations. And sometimes our interpretations are correct and sometimes they're not. And in therapy, we want people, again, to start to question their thoughts, to look at things from different perspectives, to look at things flexibly, rather than assuming that that one thought is true.
And our interpretations are going to be distorted by our negative core beliefs.
So there may be some sort of negative kind of core belief, the belief that if someone believes they're unlovable or something like that, then that may affect how they interpret a wide range of situations that occur in their lives. There may be experiences they've had in the past that contribute to that as well. If you've grown up in a home where you were constantly being criticized, for example, you may grow up believing that you're unlovable or believing that everybody's criticizing you, and that may contribute to things as well.
And how important is that to identify negative core beliefs? Do you feel like that's an important step in your process?
To identify sort of the core belief?
Right. What a client's core belief is, what might be driving this. I know that it's not helpful to stay stuck in that, like, you know, what the past experiences might be and to dwell in that kind of thing. But is it important from your perspective to at least acknowledge where, like, the root of this, for example?
Well, I think it can be important. So I've seen some people where it was really important to kind of get at the core belief, because that core belief that they had was just so powerful, and it has been around for as long as they can remember, and it was influencing how they looked at everything. Mm-hmm. Again, a belief like I'm unlovable, for example. For other clients, it's less important. There may be evidence of certain types of core beliefs, but working on the beliefs that kind of come up on a day-to-day kind of basis seems to be enough for changing the fear, and in some cases, exposure alone, not even talking about the fears, but just having people go out and do the things they're afraid of in and of itself can be effective as well. So I think it varies the extent to which you need to look at thoughts, and especially when the extent to which you need to look at sort of core beliefs varies depending on the person.
And it's so interesting, you know, as you're saying, like just going out and engaging in these experiences through exposure is so powerful. And yet I'm sure you have some clients who that are more difficult to get to do that than others that are more challenging, right?
Yeah, I mean, some people are just not willing or able to put themselves in those frightening situations. And then there's a small percentage of people who do the exposure, but it's not enough. So they're going into these situations, and regardless of what the outcome is, they're still interpreting it in a negative way, and we really need to look at the thoughts and even the core beliefs to help them to get the most they can out of their exposure practices. But again, it really depends on the person. There are some studies showing that adding the cognitive strategies to exposure does not lead to better outcomes. There are other studies showing that it does lead to better outcomes. There's kind of mixed findings out there. And in my experience, part of that is due to the fact that people are different. For some people, learning one or two strategies seems to be enough. For other people, using a different mix of strategies may be important. There's some other strategies I haven't talked about, which I'll just mention quickly.
Yes,
one is social skills training. So a lot of people who are socially anxious, not surprisingly, avoid situations. And because of that, they may not develop the skills to kind of master those situations. The same way if you're afraid of driving and you don't drive, you may not be as good a driver as someone who's got a lot of practice driving. So people may not know how to give a good presentation or how to ask someone out on a date or how to make small talk or how to give somebody negative feedback without making them angry and so on. So one of the things that we may work on with people is sort of social skills, you know, how to make appropriate eye contact, how to give a good presentation, how to make small talk and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a lot of people, their social skills are fine and that they may not need that. For other people, that may make a difference for them is knowing what to do when they're in those situations. And then the last group of strategies that we've added in this edition, we've got a new chapter in this edition, has to do with mindfulness and acceptance. So increasingly, there's research showing that strategies such as meditation that aim to teach people to be aware of their experiences without trying to control them or fight their anxiety, for example, are useful. So more acceptance-oriented strategies rather than control-oriented strategies. And to some extent, that was already built into some of the cognitive and behavioral strategies
right.
that we had before. But with mindfulness-based training, that some of that is made a lot more explicit, and we've got a new chapter describing that. And there's evidence that mindfulness-based strategies can be effective for social anxiety. There's no research really looking at whether they add anything to the existing strategy, so you know they may not. But on their own, anyway, there is often some benefit of using mindfulness-based strategies. So we're encouraging people to at least think about using those as well as part of their treatment in this book, knowing that even if they don't, the other strategies we discussed are still in and of themselves have been found to be very useful.
Absolutely. So as part of the mindfulness thing is like the acceptance piece, but also bringing it back to the moment, since a big part of anxiety, or as you explain anxiety, it's a future oriented anxiety is based on anticipation of a future experience, right? Which means you're not in the moment. Is that correct?
Yeah. And in social anxiety, we see that future oriented anticipation. We also see something that we call post-event processing, where after an event, people with social anxiety are kind of rehashing it in their minds and going
right.
through everything that went horribly, which also is not present focus. So, yeah, with mindfulness, people are encouraged to be in the moment rather than in the past or in the future.
Well, this is such a great book. And yeah, and then you have the, along with the part of the social skills, the communicating effectively, which is, everyone needs to work on that for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if you haven't been out there practicing and getting feedback, then that can be important for people.
Absolutely. Martin, this is such a great book, and I'm so impressed by your work, and I can't even imagine the number of people that you've helped, having written 30 books and doing all of the research, and it's clearly so important, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share all of this. And the book is The Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook, Proven Step-by-Step Techniques for Overcoming Your Fear, Martin Antony. Can you please tell people how to find you? You have a website that has all your books on it.
Yeah. So first, let me just thank you for all the great, wonderful things that you just said. I appreciate that. And yeah, if people want to find me, I have a website. It's martinantony.com. Antony has no H, so it's martinantony.com. And there's information on my books there and where to get them. And there's a few old out-of-print books that I have on there as well as PDF files that people can download for free. Yeah, so people can find out about me and the books there.
Yeah, and you have, when I first had you on, it was for your book, is it When Perfect Isn't Good Enough?
Yeah, it's a book on overcoming perfectionism, yeah.
Such another great book that you've written. So anyway, again, I appreciate the time that you took to discuss your workbook, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Martin.